From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Mark Report. It's the ninth day of October, 2008. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's in Decatur, Illinois. In agricultural news, a decision on Acre is imminent. Ag groups are hounding John McCain for his views on biofuels. And the SEC is charging the CEO of U.S. Sustainable with using snake oil techniques to drive the price of his company's stock. Dave Dickey will have details of these and other stories shortly. Also in this hour, we'll discuss the future of the land grant system with the former director of the Leopold Center at Iowa State. Fred Kirschman will join us in the second part of the program on most of these radio stations. Peter Levitt is away today, but Mike Tenora will join us to help us take a look at the agricultural weather forecast, and it all happens on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of WILL from the University of Illinois.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Lernard Seed Service, an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Asgrow's new Roundup Ready 2-yield soybeans. Lernard Seed Service provides services to help customers in East Central Illinois maximize profits. 217-497-2270.
Taking a look at the numbers as they settled in Chicago on a Thursday afternoon. Futures like this in the wheat pit nearby December. 3.25 lower, 604.75 was the settlement price for the soft red contract. March futures at 626, down 3 cents. May at 640.75, down 2.25. December corn at 438.25, 10.75 of a cent higher. March at 455.75, up 11.75. And the May at 467.5, up 11.75. July corn futures $4.78.25, 12.25 higher. November soybeans $9.80, 16 cents higher. January at $9.95.5, up 16.25. And the March futures at $10.09.5, 16 cents higher. May contract $10.19.75, up 16.75. October bean meal, $2.70.90, $7.20 higher. October bean oil at $39.44. Finished the day 4 cents higher in December at $39.79, up 2 cents. October live cattle futures at $92.12.5, down 32.5. December futures at $94.30, 65 cents, 100 pounds lower. October live cattle at $92.12.5, actually October feeder cattle at $98.45, down 45 cents. November's at $98.25, 27.5 lower. October lean hog futures, $66.97, finished down 90. December futures down 77.5 at 61.12.5. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. November crude oil futures, $86.66 a barrel, down $2.35. December futures at 87.25, down $1.38. Ethanol trading at $1.86, that's 2.7 higher. Natural gas at $6.82 is up 7.8, and the RBOB gasoline at $2.01.7, down 1.2 of a cent. Heating oil futures, that's diesel fuel, at $2.42, 7.3 lower, and the propane now trading at $1.19, down 5.5 for the day. October gold futures at $883.10, down $20, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average and trading at 90.62 is just about 192 points lower on the afternoon. The U.S. dollar trading at 81.08 is up 0.105 for the day, and the CRB index at 311.20, down 0.46. The Goldman Sachs 544.06. That's down 5.96 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like from our own chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser. He says tonight, sky should be clear. Lows will range from 39 in northeastern Indiana to 52 in the southern parts of the two states, mid-50s in Chicago. Tomorrow, sunny. Highs will range from 68 in far northeastern Illinois to 83 in the far south. The extended forecast says dry weather will continue during the weekend and on Monday of next week. The next chance of showers doesn't come until Monday night or Tuesday, and the model trend shows a slowing of the approach of a front and those showers next week, so it's possible the rain will hold off in many areas until Tuesday. You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from the University of Illinois. It is a production of WILL AM 580.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, resourceful by nature. Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report on a Thursday afternoon. Time to take a look at the ag futures markets. On the line with us from ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois, is Dan Zwicker. Good afternoon to you, Dan. Let's, Dan, first take a look at what's been happening in the world of agricultural markets. A little move higher today in Chicago. Tell me about the dime gain in corn.
Well, we saw some pretty good follow-through activity from yesterday's reversals that we had both in corn and soybeans. A lot of it probably can be attributed to oversold technical conditions and short covering going into tomorrow's report. But at least, I think from a technical perspective, when you look at yesterday's reversal and then now some decent follow-through activity in both corn and soybeans, at least the market appears to have found some stability here for a minute anyway. I still think, you know, is still watching the outside market activity, what may or may not happen over there. But at least for the day or so here, we've been able to kind of divorce ourselves from the negative action that we're seeing in some of the outside market activities.
Please tell me what you see in tomorrow morning's report.
Well, I guess, like I told Dave, when it comes to October crop reports, I always put on my seatbelt. There's for some reason or the other that they have a tendency to have surprises in them either way, but I guess, you know, when you look at the trade averages, I guess I can't necessarily argue against them. I don't have any more information than the trade has, but the yields that at least we're hearing here in Illinois on the bean front's pretty good. I think when I look at FC Stone's survey here that they issued here a week or two ago, I guess I kind of think that they might be pretty close to the, you know, in line with what may happen here.
Well, those numbers reflected at this point in any way in the marketplace. I know we've been moving with the outside markets. Is there movement to justify what comes out in the crop production report tomorrow morning?
I would say that if the soybean yield comes in underneath 40, that's going to be viewed as generally positive. The market, anything, and of course the, you know, how much under 40 it does come in, but I think 40 is kind of the number everybody kind of want to pivot from, or 39.5. But if we come in underneath the 40 number, that's going to be generally positive. Soybeans, again, if we come in above it, it may temper some of the upside enthusiasm that we've seen in soybeans the last day or two. But, you know, a lot of the strength that we've seen in beans anyway has been pretty well demand driven. Asian demand pretty well came in here over the past week here, and we put in some pretty good sales numbers. And then, of course, this is the start of the South American growing season. So all eyes are focused in South America to see what kind of acreage levels they're going to increase. The early growing season weather, how that may or may not impact total production.
Do you think that they can afford to increase acres at $10 a bushel?
Well, probably, you know, it depends. I mean, to my understanding, it costs them about $10 to produce them, and it takes about $3 in transportation. But again, if they've got land there that needs to be farmed, they'll probably farm it. If it's a 1 or 2% increase, so be it. It doesn't look like, at least the prices are such, that we're going to see any big increase out of South America. But at least the private estimates that I've seen indicate that there's room anyway for a slight uptick in overall acreage.
Well, that brings me to the following question, which is, do you think that Chicago actually reflects the value of corn or beans at this point? True value.
Well, I don't know what beam. I guess I'm enough of a marketer that this is the value. The market knows supposedly all the fundamental events and what is known to the public, and then some is figured into the price of soybeans and corn. So, that's as of today. Tomorrow things can change, and next week can change. But I think you have to say that the market knows all, at least at this point. But the market is going all the time, and it changes its opinion all the time.
Have the financial markets changed your cyclic analysis at all? I mean, have we shortened up, lengthened cycles? Where do we?
No, not really. I mean, beans are right in the window here to record an 8-week cycle low. We should have, to really confirm it, you need to have a higher weekly finish, and at least we're in the hunt for that. If we got a bullish report, would move 15, 20 higher tomorrow, we would have a higher weekly finish, and I think that would solidify at least an 8-week cycle low in corn. It could also maybe begin to solidify a seasonal low. This is the time of year when you usually have a low in soybeans during the first 10 days or so of October. So at least soybeans seem to be following a seasonal pattern fairly closely, but we need some confirmation, from USA's crop estimate, and then we probably need to see some more demand come in and some stabilization outside market. I mean, there's one thing that I look at the outside markets, the dollar has kind of went into a congestion phase in here, at least for right now, and if it would decide to take a push right on up through the top, you could argue probably for about another $5 or $6 run in the dollar, take it up into the mid-80s. That would be bearish commodities if that would happen, because anytime you strengthen a dollar, that's going to signal more deflationary pressures, at least in the commodity world, whether it's going to be crude oil, gold, silver, corn, and soybeans. So I think that's the thing to kind of watch, is that the dollar is consolidating a little bit, and I think if it would decide to break to the upside, we've got a $5 or $6 run to go, and I think it would send it up into around the $86 level, and that would be bearish commodities.
Have you done any of that same sort of look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average to put some numbers on it?
Well, the Dow Jones, the only thing you really got to look at is some retracement levels off of the 2002 low that we had here, about 71.97.
Mm-hmm.
We're down about the last of the retracement levels to hold, or otherwise the gates really begin to open up for a solid test of that low down there around 71.97. And that is like a 76.4% retracement, which comes into play around this 88-8900 level. And, of course, we're right here at 89.65. So we're down at the last of the retracement levels based upon Fibonacci ratios. That would be a place of support here. If that gives way, then everybody's going to begin to talk about a solid challenge of that 2002 low.
Thanks much for joining us today.
Very well.
All right, that's Dan Zwicker. He's with ADM Grain Group out of Decatur, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report. It happens each and every Thursday afternoon.
The Closing Market Report is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at AgriGold.com or at 800-262-7333.
Dan Zwicker talked a little bit about Fibonacci numbers there at the end. If you don't know what those are, I urge you to go check them out on the web. They occur in nature and in the marketplace.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Stuart Peterson, For over 20 years, Stuart Peterson has helped farmers manage both marketing opportunities and risks through their analysis, advice, and action. Stuart Peterson, confidence like never before. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
In agricultural news, USDA Secretary Ed Schaefer says a decision is imminent on how USDA will interpret the Farm Bill's language on the new average crop revenue election program. There has been controversy over which years to use as the baseline to create the national average price for commodities. The White House wants USDA to save money and use the 2006-2008 crop years. Congress wants USDA to use the 2007-2009 crop years, which would likely result in a more robust safety net. Agricultural groups are continuing to criticize Republican presidential candidate John McCain for saying he can reduce the price of food by eliminating subsidies on ethanol and agricultural goods. Key commodity groups yesterday issued statements against McCain's plan, including the National Association of Wheat Growers, the American Farm Bureau Federation, and the National Farmers Union. The U.S. Security Exchange Commission has charged the CEO of U.S. Sustainable Energy Corporation with using snake oil salesman techniques to drive up the price of his company's stock. John Rivers claimed he could use a specially designed catalyst of his creation to make 5 gallons of bio crude out of 1 bushel of soybeans feedstock in just 8 minutes. Rivers then claimed his biofuel has higher per energy content than regular unleaded or premium gasoline or even jet fuel. Rivers also claimed he applied for a patent on the process. The SEC says all of Rivers' claims are false. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich has appointed Tom Jennings director of the State Department of Agriculture. Jennings has worked in the Department of Agriculture for the past 30 years, beginning his career as a grain warehouse examiner in 1978. He has a degree in agricultural economics from the University of Illinois. And a new government report says ranchers and producers lost nearly $11 billion between 2004 and 2007 while foreign nations banned U.S. beef due to mad cow disease. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming at WILL. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report and Commodity Week, reminding you to stay with us if you can this afternoon. In the second half hour of the program on most of these radio stations, we'll talk about the future of the land grant system. The former director of the Leopold Center at Iowa State will join us. His name is Fred Kirschman. Now, up next, USDA's Agricultural Research Service team, based on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, is working to improve weed control in sweet corn. As you'll hear, unlike its field corn cousin, sweet corn does not take so well to herbicides, and planting date makes a great big difference. Weeds are a problem in sweet corn. Field corn, mostly fed to livestock or processed for human consumption, is a hardy row crop and can withstand the rigors of being treated with a herbicide. Not so much the case for sweet corn. And to complicate matters, this crop, canned and consumed by humans, does not compete so well in the field with weeds, especially if it's planted too early in the season, says University of Illinois weed scientist Marty Williams.
The crop, when it's planted in June and early July, is more tolerant to weeds that are incompletely controlled. The crop grows differently, it's more competitive, and the threat of weeds in a late planted sweet corn crop aren't nearly as severe as they are in April or May planting.
The point the USDA ARS scientist makes is that a grower with a field known to be weedy should plant it to sweet corn later in the season. That'll give the crop the upper hand on the weeds.
The crop can suffer up to 85% yield loss without any weed control in an early May planting. Take the same weed population, plant the crop in late June, and the most we could see in yield loss was 15%.
So just moving the planting date of a field can help control weeds through increased competition from the sweet corn plant. Remember, it's a plant that does not always tolerate herbicides. The ARS scientist is working on an answer to that problem, too. He says the gene that metabolizes five different chemical modes of action sometimes does not work right. It's mutated. Fixing that mutation, breeding it out, could fix the problem and improve the vigor of sweet corn.
We've done some work and found that every sweet corn seed company in the U.S., every major one, has germplasm that's sensitive, and it's related to the pattern that we found. And so it's an industry-wide problem, and it's something that's been their number, the food processing industry, this has been their number one weed issue that they shared when I started here. And I think we're on track to helping them actually solve that where it's a non-issue here in a few more years.
That is, if the USDA ARS unit at the U of I has a few more years to work on the problem. It's slated for closure. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Risk Management Commodities, with offices in Chalmers and Lafayette, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities provides commodities analysis and recommendations for business and agriculture throughout East Central Illinois and Western Indiana. 866-837-9027.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a Thursday afternoon, and we're joined by John Marlin this afternoon from the U of I. He's with the Sustainable Agricultural Program here. He's going to tell us a little bit about some activities that are coming up that involve our guest that will be on the second half hour of this program today. His name is Fred Kirschman, and he'll be on campus, I think, John, on Monday of this coming week. Is that right?
Yes, it'll be Monday, October 13th.
And what is Fred going to address here on campus, and where, and is it open to the public?
It's going to be open to the public in the Illini Union Room 314 at 4 p.m., and he's going to discuss the future role of land-grant universities.
And
how they can address sustainability issues.
And why are we taking that up on this campus?
Well, I think there's two conflicting conceptions about land grants, and it sometimes polarizes the agricultural community. Some people see land grants as only dealing with chemical inputs and large agricultural production, and they say that's bad. Other people say that the technologies that these land grants are providing are actually vital to our farmers, and they're allowing us to achieve success here and internationally. Fred feels that neither of these conceptions are useful or beneficial, so he's going to talk about how we can bring the community together and move forward.
All right, and again, he will be where and at what time?
Will be in the Illini Union Room 314 at 4 p.m. on Monday, October 13th.
And it's open to the public.
Yes, it is.
All right. Thanks much, John.
Bye.
John Marlin is with the Sustainable Agricultural Program here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, giving us a quick preview of our guest for the second half hour, the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report. His name is Fred Kirschman, former director of the Leopold Center out of Iowa State. He'll tell us a little bit more about how he sees the future of the land grant system in this great nation of ours. In just 2 minutes, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. Mike Tenora will be with us. I'm Todd Gleason.
With this look at AM 580 News, I'm Tom Rogers. As economic uncertainty continues, the heads of Illinois state employee retirement systems are trying to reassure participants that their pension money is still safe. In a mutual statement, they say pension money is protected by the state constitution and it's being invested in a broad way that isn't over-dependent on stocks. But they also acknowledge that Illinois' investment portfolios have suffered in the latest market downturn, though they also expect an eventual recovery. The FBI is assisting several local police agencies after a note threatening a shooting was found on the U of I's Urbana campus. Campus police say the note was discovered Sunday in a men's room at the undergraduate library, indicating that a shooting would occur on Green Street Halloween night. In the note, the person leaving it also claimed responsibility for damaging a vehicle window outside the Savoy 16 theaters on Friday. Officers are requesting anybody with information on either of the incidents to contact U of I police or calling Crime Stoppers at 373-TIPS. Republican Steve Sauerberg and Democrat Dick Durbin are slated to face off again in their second debate this week. Sauerberg and Durbin meet tonight in the only full-length debate of their race for the U.S. Senate. It'll air on commercial radio stations across the state. A federal mediator will once again try to help teachers and administrators at Rantoul Township High School come together on a contract agreement. But a spokesman for the union says no other meetings are scheduled after tonight's session. Bargaining began last spring. A proposed state law that would require Indiana moped operators to have valid driver's licenses and insurance is meeting resistance from some operators and retailers. Lafayette Republican State Senator Ron Alting says he plans to present a bill in the upcoming session of the Indiana General Assembly that would set the license and insurance requirements for moped riders and require the vehicles to have license plates. The owner of a motorcycle shop in Lafayette says that with gas prices so high, it's the wrong time to impose more regulations on mopeds. Currently, anyone age 15 and older can operate a moped on Indiana roads. I'm Tom Rogers, AM 580 News.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a Thursday afternoon. Pete Lavitt is away, but good news is that TStorm.net's meteorologist and commodity analyst Mike Tenora is with us this afternoon, also a graduate of the University of Illinois. Thanks for filling in this afternoon for us, Mike.
Hey, not a problem, Todd. Not a problem at all.
No, well, what do you see in the weather forecast?
Well, things are actually looking pretty ideal here for a little while, at least, you know, across most of the Corn Belt. Will have a very large warm-up over the next 2 to 3 days and really lingering through Sunday, at least for Illinois. And so great harvest weather. I mean, we'll be seeing about as good as it can get, with highs in the 70s to 80s across a real large section of the central U.S. That's all due to a very large system that will be developing across the Rockies this weekend. And that will actually lead to the first major snowstorm for parts of the plains, mainly in eastern Montana and into the far western Dakotas. So while we'll be sitting, you know, in Illinois in the 70s and 80s, it's kind of hard to believe that, you know, less than 600-700 miles, well, maybe 1,000 miles, let's say, but not really that far in meteorological terms, there'll be a snowstorm going on. Eventually, that'll lead to rain across the Corn Belt, especially from Missouri, Iowa, and west. And in that area, it certainly looks like there'll be a full stoppage of corn and soybean harvesting, as well as hard red winter wheat planting going on from Sunday through Tuesday. As far as Illinois and to the east, we'll be kind of on the edge of the whole issue coming across. So while there will be some rain beginning on Tuesday and ending on Wednesday, at this point it doesn't look like we'll see a whole lot more than a half of an inch. So it shouldn't be a real large problem for harvesting in the central and eastern Corn Belt.
So the western Corn Belt is going to come to a screeching halt Sunday, Monday, Tuesday of next week, and maybe Wednesday, and a couple days after that. How much rainfall?
Well, that's a good question. At this point, a widespread one-inch rains look pretty good from western Texas through Kansas, Nebraska, into Iowa and Missouri, and even localized 2 to 3 inch amounts seem like a pretty decent bet for parts of those areas, too. So it'll be a fairly significant event, but, you know, let's say you get 2 inches of rain in Kansas City. As you progress eastward to Champaign-Urbana, there might only be a half of an inch. So the drop-off will be pretty dramatic. And then once you go to the east of Champaign and into Indiana and Ohio, even lower totals. And again, the rain in Illinois wouldn't even begin until Tuesday, so that's a full 5 days of ideal weather until it arrives. So you know, and after that system goes through, it doesn't look like it'll be real cold or real wet, so kind of a drier and seasonably cool pattern, so not a big deal. I think, you know, things should pick back up in all areas by late next week and next weekend.
Mike, thanks for filling in for us this afternoon.
No problem. Have a good one.
You too. Mike Tenora is with TStorm.net. You can visit his website online. He's a commodity analyst and a meteorologist joining us here on a Thursday afternoon for the Closing Market Report. for those of you who are leaving us, thank you, and goodbye for the afternoon. For the rest of you, in just a few moments, we'll be joined by Fred Kirschman. He's a former director of the Leopold Center in Des Moines, Iowa, and we'll talk about the future of the land-grant system. This is the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason. We're going to talk a little bit this afternoon over the next 25 minutes or so about the future of the land grant system in the United States. We'll take your phone calls as well if you'd like to get lined up to talk to Fred Kirschman. He'll be on campus on Monday afternoon of next week at the Illini Union, where you can listen to him have a full conversation about the future of the land grant system. But we'll take your phone calls for him this afternoon at 217-333-9455. That's 217-333-WILL or 800-222-9455. I'll repeat those in a moment. But first, I'd like to say hello to Mr. Kirschman. Thank you for joining us from, you're a little farther west than I thought you might be at this point, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm actually in Montana.
Well, that's not too bad. They have a land-grant university there as well.
They do, absolutely.
Well, we all have land-grant universities each and every state, don't we?
Yep.
Tell me about the system.
Well, the land-grant university is an incredible invention. Was created, of course, by the Morrill Act mid-1800s, and the original idea behind, and it was, called the People's University, and the original idea behind it was to teach and educate, as they call them, the industrial classes, meaning the ordinary citizen. The idea was that, people of substance and wealth and industries, had the necessary resources to find the information, et cetera, that they needed, but that the ordinary citizen didn't, and so the land grant was created to fill that vacuum.
How do you see the future of the land grant as we move into this century?
Well, it's a lot of things, of course, have happened, and I think the mission of the land grant has changed to some extent. It certainly still attempts to meet the needs of the industrial classes. But it has been focused much more on research, I think, in recent years, probably really since the end of the Second World War, and that's not a bad thing. But you always have to raise the question on what the research is focused on. What are the primary things that we're trying to accomplish with research now? And in my view, I think that, most of our research now is really focused on developing new technologies, and those certainly play an important role. But we are not, in my view, spending sufficient attention or giving sufficient attention to some of the unintended consequences of the technologies that we're creating, and whether or not those technologies are really going to serve us well as we move into the future with the new challenges that we're going to be facing. So there are a lot of big challenges, confronting all of us, but our land grant universities as well. And so the question I think we have to raise is, how do the land grant universities need to reinvent themselves now in order to meet the challenges that we're going to be facing? And among those challenges, there are a number of them, but we know that our energy situation is going to change dramatically because the end of cheap energy is now upon us. We have also drawn down our fresh water resources at an unsustainable rate, so we have to ask ourselves how we are going to manage, our human economies with probably about half the amount of fresh water that we're currently using. And we know that the climate is going to change. And wherever people may feel, whatever they may think about, the current debate around climate change, the science is pretty clear about it. But more importantly, one of the things that the National Academy of Sciences pointed out already back in 1975 is that the climate, the unusual, or as they called it, abnormal stable climate, which we've had over the last 100 years, is not the norm, and therefore we should not expect that will stay. So we're likely going to see more unstable climates. So how do we, maintain our quality of life, meet our needs, and particularly, my primary interest is in food and agriculture. You know, how do we continue to provide an adequate amount of food under those new circumstances? I think those are some of the new challenges that we need to be addressing.
I'd like to go back to a point you made earlier, and I want to know why it is that you think the land grants are avoiding the science of the impact of technology in favor of the science of the technology itself.
Yeah. That's a really good question, and I think part of it is because of the predominant narrative. What do I mean by narrative? It's a, we all operate out of a vision, out of a way that we think about life in general, and our institutions are no different from that. Scott Peters published an essay a couple of years ago in which he pointed out there are actually two narratives now which dominate the thinking in our land-grant universities. And one is what he calls the heroic narrative. You know, we're the institution that created the technologies which are, increasing the yields of our crops and producing all of these great things. And, and of course, when you operate out of that kind of narrative, then you don't really see much need for change or, you just keep doing more of what you've been doing. And then he says there's a second narrative, and that's the what he calls the tragic narrative. And those are the people who are saying, you invented all these technologies. That's precisely the problem. That's what's causing climate change. That's what's causing us to pollute our water and causing hypoxia zones in the Gulf of Mexico, et cetera, et cetera. And again, if you operate out of that tragic narrative, you're also not likely to see much change because you're saying, the dominant narrative is so much in control, there's nothing we can do about it. And so Scott argues that one of the things we should be doing in our land-grant universities now is to think about what our new narrative should be. How should we be thinking about ourselves if we're going to face these new challenges that we're confronted with? And so I think part of the reason that we haven't looked at the unintended consequences of our technologies is because, we're caught up in this heroic narrative, and so we don't see the need to do it.
Hmm. Is it part and parcel of chasing dollars?
Well, yeah, I mean, that certainly also plays a role. Our land-grant universities are still predominantly funded by public funds. It varies from state to state. In Iowa, if I recall, I think we're a little over 70% of our funding comes from public dollars. But then you have funding come in from the outside, from the private sector, that provides research for particular kinds of research. And, of course, you do want to pay attention to that funding, and you don't want to see it disappear. And so it was, it would be abnormal to not pay some attention, to that and to, to hone your message that's favorable to, the people that are giving you additional funding.
So let's go back to where you were headed with the heroic and the tragic narratives and suggesting that we need to change the narrative altogether. What do you have for suggestions?
Well, Scott Peters says that the new narrative should be centered on what he calls sustainability and freedom. In other words, how do we solve these problems? How do we address these challenges that we're facing? How do we keep things? How do we keep going? How do we keep, how do we maintain a quality of life? And we have to have more engagement of the general public in this. That's where the freedom part comes in. That there's much more openness and involvement of average citizens in helping us to think through, how we're going to. So in other words, so that we're doing this together and not, I think a big mistake that we often make is that we look to particular institutions and some of us look to our land-grant universities to kind of be the lone ranger and come in and save us. That generally doesn't work because then there's no engagement and ownership in it and people haven't felt involved. And so I think we need to have much more community engagement. And in my reading, at least, that was part of the original vision of the land grant. That's why it was called the People's University. And there are some countries that are doing this now. In Denmark, for example, they now have science shops so that scientists actually are out in the community in various locations, and people from the community can come and say, I'm facing this kind of problem. Can you help me with some research, that can solve this problem? I'm not saying that's the answer to everything, but it's one way to approach that engagement, which I think we need.
You're talking about something different than what came along later than the land grants, the extension service. You're talking about something different than that?
Yeah, this was in,
But is that what you're suggesting, though, something that would be in addition to or different than the engagement or the outreach programs that are operated by land grant systems?
Well, I think, I think it can, I think, for example, I think that the extension service now, which, of course, came along a little bit later with the Smith-Lieber Act,
right.
I think extension now is more important than it's ever been in its history, because many of the problems that we're facing now are not going to be solved with technology. They're going to be solved by people working together, thinking together. By creating new way, finding new ways to manage farming systems. For example, as energy costs continue to go up, at least as I've looked at what are the alternatives here. Well, one of the alternatives, and there's some farmers all over the world now that are on a very small scale are starting to do this, and that is instead of farming specialized monocultures, which always require a lot of energy input. They're now developing highly biological synergies. In other words, they have some animals in the system, they have some plants in the system, and everything that's in the system, every species that's in the system, contributes energy as well as taking energy. So you have Joel Salatin in Virginia, for example, who has a rotational grazing system, and he now has, I think, 7 species of animals that go through that system. He puts the beef cattle into the paddock first. They're in there for 24 hours. Then he moves them on to the next paddock. 90 hours later, he brings in the chickens. Why the chickens in 90 hours? Well, in 90 hours is when the grubs and the larvae and the cow pies have developed, so they're perfect feed for chickens. So the chickens feed on that, and in the process of feeding on that, they scratch the cow pies around it, spreads the manure for more fertilizer, for more grass. So I think how do we begin to manage systems that produce their own energy in that way rather than being dependent on energy from outside? Extension is in a perfect role, to work with farmers to try to think through some of those kinds of systems, so they aren't just technology transfer individuals anymore. They become active people engaged in trying to work with farmers and with others to develop these new approaches.
We need to take a break here in just about 2 minutes, so be prepared for that. And then
we'll
ask if you want to join that conversation with Fred Kirschman this afternoon, you can. The numbers are 333-9455, that's 217 locally, or 800-222-9455. We'll take a break in a couple of minutes. So tell me more about this, because I'm wondering, is it possible to have folks like Joel work into the bigger system? Because it seems to me that the bigger industrial system just demands more of the same from him in greater quantities. Can he manage to pull off the smaller system that has a greater number of species and continue to work through the kind of food processing system already in place?
Well, that's actually the research question, I think, that we need to be addressing. Can some of these kinds of systems be scaled up? I think they can, but we won't know until we can actually do the research and create the models and see whether or not they work. The other thing is that, and there are a number of people now who are we have focused our current industrial agriculture system's efficiency entirely on labor efficiency. It's not energy efficient. It's very labor efficient, and we have prided ourselves and felt that that was the only efficiency that we really needed to accomplish. So we now at a point, as of the 2002 statistics, where we only have a little over 400,000 farmers who are producing 94% of our food. So it's enormously labor efficient.
Fred, we'll take that labor efficiency up in 2 minutes, okay? Thanks much. Fred Kirschman is with the Leopold Center, where he's a former director. We're talking about sustainability and the land grant system here on the Closing Market Report.
WILL programming is made possible by Tires Plus Total Car Care, located at Prospect and Market View in Champaign. Tires Plus provides complete car repair and maintenance. More information is available at 366-3201.
Let's take a quick look at the forecast for the two-state region. Former on Chief Meteorologist Ed Kieser. Here's what the extended forecast highlights look like. Ed says dry weather will continue during the weekend and on into Monday of next week. The next chance of showers doesn't come until Monday night or Tuesday, and the model trend shows a slowing of the approach of that front, and that those showers next week might even hold off until late on Tuesday in many areas. Warmer than average temperature readings are expected through early next week. That'll favor, of course, harvesting conditions across Illinois and Indiana. Slightly cooler weather expected during the middle of next week, but that'll quickly be followed by the return of some seasonably warm weather. Ed says the latest American GFS model puts sub-freezing temperatures into much of North Dakota, northwestern Minnesota on Monday morning, and then takes that cold northeastward, missing most of the Midwestern Corn Belt. The models are now holding off an additional cold air through October the 22nd. Beyond that, accuracy, of course, is a little low on those models, according to our own Ed Kieser. Here's what the forecast for the two-state region looks like tonight. Clear, says Ed, lows will range from 39 in northeastern Indiana to 52 in the south, and the mid-50s along Chicago's lakefront. Tomorrow, sunny, highs will range from 68 in far northeastern Illinois to 83 in the far south.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Campaña Flamenco José Porcel on October 10th. This energetic dance troupe will be followed with a free afterglow performance in the lobby from Eastern Bloc. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
Just about 7 more minutes to continue our conversation this afternoon here on the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report with Fred Kirschman. He's former director of the Leopold Center at Iowa State. We're talking about the land grant system and sustainable agriculture across the United States and around the globe. Just a bit when we left, our discussion was centering around labor efficiency in the United States and how the focus has been on labor efficiency as opposed to energy use. Would you like to continue on with that conversation, Fred?
Yeah, sure. So I think that energy, one of the things we'll find is that energy costs go up. There will be a point at which labor will have a comparative advantage to energy, and then how will that change agriculture? Well, there are several people that have tried to begin to anticipate that, and Richard Heinberg, who's with the New College in California, for example, he's now predicting that by the year 2030, 2040, we could have as many as 40 to 50 million people that will be engaged in producing our food in one way or another, you know, growing more of their own food and gardens, community gardens. He sees an increase in horticulture, agriculture versus grain agriculture, grain and animal agriculture. You know, I'm not saying he's got all of that right, but we do have, you know, we have people who are trying to envision, you know, how this impact of, you know, one of the ways of thinking about this is suppose that oil was $300 a barrel. And, you know, T. Boone Pickens is now telling us it'll be $350 in the next 10 years. So it's not an unreasonable, you know, target to peg it on. So let's suppose that oil was $300 a barrel, that we can only use half the amount of water that we're currently using, and that we have twice the severe weather events. You know, what kind of agriculture would we put on the landscape so that it would continue to be productive? Well, I think it would be a much more diverse agriculture than we have now. It would obviously be one that requires a lot less energy, probably would require more labor, but that would be an exchange that probably would be acceptable to us. So we really have to start thinking in those terms, I think, and not continue to stay locked into the current narrative, which is totally based on maximum production and short-term return, because what we're going to need is resilient production and long-term return. And so that's one of the shifts I think we have to make in our thinking.
So a couple of decades ago, there was something called LISA, Low Impact Sustainable Agriculture.
Right.
Would that be something you can see coming back?
Well, it actually is with us still, because LISA got transformed into SARE, the Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, which is still operating. And I think the SARE program has done some research which is going to be helpful to us. But we still got a long way to go. We got a lot of new models that we have to test out. I think our future agriculture is going to be much more adapted to local situations. So we're not going to have one seed variety that's used all over the world. We're going to have seed that's locally adapted to local cultures and local climates. We're going to have more animal crop mixtures that are adapted to local place with breeds that are adapted to local place. And I think those, from some of the early evidence we've seen, these mixed agriculture systems, because you're going to be producing more than one commodity off the same acreage, can be enormously productive and resilient.
Are there places around the nation that are more likely to do this than others? For instance, here in the Prairie State, it would seem unlikely that that could happen.
Yeah, we're already seeing this. You know, right now these new approaches are happening more on the coast than they are in the, you know, in the central part of the country. But we're seeing some of it in the central part of the country. You know, there's a farmer near Albia, Iowa, for example, who's experimenting with raising grapes and sweet corn and poultry all together in the same system. So the poultry provides the fertility by virtue of the poultry droppings. The poultry eat the insects and the weed seedlings as they come up, so he doesn't have to cultivate the corn after it's about 4 inches tall. You know, and according to, and again, the SARE program did a research project to do the numbers on that, and they concluded that he was doing about $10,000 an acre net profit. Now, I don't know a lot of, you know, monoculture farmers that are, you know, creating that kind of profit. Now, it's a much more complex system. You know, a lot of people don't like that kind of complexity. The thing that I'm finding, though, now is that young people all across the country want to start farming now, and they're interested, and they're not, you know, they grew up on the internet. They're not afraid of complexity. In fact, they welcome it. So I think we're going to see a lot of changes that we should again. You know, encourage and have some conversations about, and really look at a lot of different alternatives, and not get locked into one way of doing things, because I think that would not prepare us for the future.
And you think that the land grant system should be responsible for looking at that?
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, if it truly is the people's university as it was originally envisioned, then it needs to listen to the people, and it needs to make more opportunities for different approaches rather than, you know, right now we're putting about 90% of our research dollars into new technologies. Well, what about if we put, say, 30 or 40% of our research dollars into restoring the health of our soil? Because that's a critical piece. You know, all the research has been done on this. We know that healthy soil, healthy biologically active soil, only uses about half the amount of water. So that begins to prepare you for, you know, more drought periods. So there's just a lot of things that we could do in terms of looking at new options and new possibilities, and then let's see what works, and what works will get adopted then.
Well, Dr. Kirschman, we look forward to having you on campus next week on Monday.
I'm looking forward to it as well.
Okay, Dr. Kirschman. Fred Kirschman is former director of the Leopold Center at Iowa State. And of course, he will be here on campus on Monday next week at 4 o'clock in the Illini Union. If you'd like to come and see him talk in person, you can do that. It's open to the public. That's at 4 p.m. next Monday right here on this campus in Urbana-Champaign. Dr. Fred Kirschman will be here, a former director of the Leopold Center. We've been talking to him this afternoon on the Harvest Hour edition of the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason.